So this evening, we're thinking about predators. And I know we've got some budding naturalists in the room, but these are not just any old predators. I'm afraid we're thinking about people who predate on those they're meant to be leading and protecting. Religious leaders who exploit those they're meant to be serving. And we're thinking about those false leaders in comparison to the leader who is true and trustworthy and kind and committed to his people and powerful to fight off the enemy, Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd. And because we are vulnerable to false leadership in our lives, and there's a lot of it about. You know, think of the TV evangelists who are building empires for themselves, the prosperity gospel preachers who are after your money with false promises of fulfillment and healing, success in life. The liberal theologians making good careers out of very clever books that find new ways of suppressing and denying biblical truth. And you might think, well, I'd never fall for any of those, Will. I know better than that. But this also includes any pastor, myself included, any author, any preacher who might be very popular online, who willfully twists the Bible to avoid the bits that aren't easy listening, like sin or judgment, for the sake of growing his following, or who pushes any even slightly different gospel to the genuine one. Religious leaders who aren't to be trusted are all over the place. And just like today, that was the case in Jesus' day, as John's about to show us. And perhaps the biggest way of all in which they damage their listeners is that they seduce people away from the one true, trustworthy leader who we're going to look at now. And in this passage, we're going to see briefly three things about him. So if you're filling in the blanks on the handout and the service program, three things. I'll give you cards on the table right now. His authentication, in other words, how he shows he's our true leader. Second, his blessings. And third, his sacrifice. So first, his authentication. And this is verses 1 to 6. Let me read from verse 1 again. Just before I do, if I explain how keeping sheep worked in the ancient Near East, these verses are going to make a lot more sense. So typically, if you can picture it, a sheepfold would basically be a large enclosure surrounded by a wall, and it would be almost like the village co-op. Like multiple different flocks would all be herded together in the sheep enclosure for the night, for safety. And every night, once all the village shepherds had come together after the day and dropped off their flocks in the enclosure, got their sheep safely, and they'd head off for the night, and a gatekeeper would come, and he would take over. He was like the nightclub bouncer of the ancient world, and he would watch over the whole enclosure until morning. And throughout the night, he would stay by the one and only door to the enclosure, and he'd probably have a big club or some kind of weapon, and the only other way, other than through the door, that robbers could get in to steal sheep would be over the wall. But that's not going to help them much because the sheep can't get over the wall. So either way, they're going to have to go through the door at some point, anyone who wants to steal sheep. And then in the morning, the shepherds would arrive back. And if they were true shepherds, they would go to the door and they would call their flocks. The gatekeeper would recognize them, he'd let them in, and they'd call their particular flock. And their flock, even though all the flocks were kind of intermingled in the night, all of the sheep in their flock would recognize their voice and follow them out and go out for the day to graze and be cared for by them. So does that make sense? That's the cultural context that Jesus' listeners here would have been thinking about when he said this stuff. Let's go from verse 1 and picture that as you hear these words. Verse 1, "Truly, truly, I say to you," says Jesus, "he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door but climbs in another way, that man is a thief and a robber." You might be thinking, what's the difference, thief and a robber? Well, there is a difference. Thief is the idea of stealing by stealth. Okay, robber is the idea of stealing by force. And this is the false leadership we were talking about earlier. And false leaders follow one of these two paths to this day. So some of them are going to try and trick us down the wrong path, seduce us down the wrong theological or spiritual path. We won't even know what they're doing, and that's the thief. That's the false teacher who's who's funny and flattering and inspiring and intellectually intriguing, has these amazing sound bites and makes you feel good about yourself. That's the thief. If it's any other gospel or if he has any other motives than your good and the glory of God. On the other hand, other false leaders will try and pressure us down the wrong path and bully us down the wrong path and maybe guilt us, for example, into being legalistic. Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? And that's the robber. That's the pastor who maybe does heavy shepherding and is domineering and bullying and controlling about all of the details in your life and leads you away from the saving grace of Jesus Christ that way by his force of personality, which dominates you. And that's the robber. Reading on from verse 2, Jesus says, "But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens." And that's Jesus. And then we get this feature which authenticates him as being the true shepherd. And here's our first point, his authentication. And the feature that authenticates him as our shepherd is this. It's his call and our response. Okay? His call and our response. Reading on in verse 3. "The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out." So they respond. Same thing again in verse 4. "When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him." Why? Someone tell me, end of verse 4. Why do the sheep follow him? Because they know his voice. That's what it says. And we get the same thing again implied by its opposite in verse 5. "A stranger they will not follow." Let's say the gatekeeper was dopey, hadn't fully woken up yet, and some shepherd blagged his way in, saying that he was the same guy who dropped them off the night before. "But a stranger they will not follow. They will flee from him." Why? Jesus says, "For they do not know the voice of a stranger." So yet again, in John, this is the other way round, if you were listening closely, the exact opposite way around to how we might expect it. John loves doing this, does it all the time. Let me just unpick that for you, how this is the opposite way around to what you would assume. According to Jesus in verse 4, not me saying this, look at Jesus in verse 4, it is not that we follow him and therefore come to know his voice. No, according to Jesus in verse 4, it's that we already know his voice and therefore that we come to follow him. So for all of us who are believers here tonight, there was a moment when you heard the call of Jesus and it just rang true and you found yourself drawn to him. I wonder when that happened for you. Think back to when you became a Christian, if you are a Christian here. It might have been a particular sermon when you were a teenager or a college student. It might have been a Bible study, maybe a Sunday school class when you were 4 or 6 or 8. Might have been a conversation with a friend who was witnessing to you, or a Christian book that you read, or reading the Bible for yourselves. Even occasionally, for people without access to the scriptures, it can be a dream. I just, this last week, read about an ex-Hamas member, terrorist, who is now a Christian because Jesus Christ appeared to him in a dream. And so through whatever medium it was, each of us believers heard the voice of the Good Shepherd calling us. We found that we recognized it. And because of that, we found ourselves getting up and following him. In other words, repenting and believing. Now, John's gospel is very big on the truth that God chooses his people beforehand. That's why we recognize his voice, then start following him, not the other way around. And the Bible presents this truth as a wonderful reassurance to Christians that they're secure, that they're firmly buckled into salvation, as Billy helpfully put it to me earlier this week, that they had already been chosen, they're secure. Imagine, you know, picture a Dollywood ride. The G-forces are trying to rip you out of that seat as much as they can. You're buckled in. So it's a little bit scary, at least for people like me, but you know it's safe. You're buckled in, firmly, securely. That belt buckle is God choosing us beforehand. So the G-forces of sin and Satan and the world and the flesh and the devil ripping you, trying to rip you out of that seat, and not going to. You're already his. He already chose you. You're buckled in. But this can sometimes trouble people a little bit if it leaves them wondering, well, did God choose me? Like, did he choose me? How can I know? I can think he did, but how can I have confidence? And the simple reassuring answer to that is, look at the cross. What do you see? And if you see the Son of God laying down his life to pay for your sin so that his heavenly Father can accept you forever, there you go. You were chosen. Or we could put it this way. If you're anxious about whether or not God chose you before the foundation of the world, in the language of Ephesians 1, let me ask you this. Do you have any desire to repent of your sin and trust in Jesus' death to pay for it? And do you have any desire to try and live with him as your Lord instead of living for yourself? If you do, if you find that you can repent, that you can trust in Jesus' death to pay for it, that you want to live for him and not yourself, there you go. That's your answer. He did choose you. And that would be you knowing his voice. Verse 4, his sheep follow him, for they know his voice. Your ability to see that and to do that, most people don't have. That's why they're not Christians. The fact that you can see that and want to do that and are able to do that is all the evidence in the world that God chose you. That's why you recognize his voice. That's why you then follow him. There's another striking feature of the shepherd's call in this passage, and it's tucked away in verse 3. Someone tell me, how does the shepherd call his own sheep? Is he like, oi, number 33792, hurry up. Verse 3, how does he call his sheep? By name, brilliant, thank you. Still to this day in the Middle East, shepherds have names for specific sheep, like long ears or white nose. And with us, Jesus isn't like, oh, he looks down, there's big ears, and I see he's preaching at Emmanuel again tonight. No, we're more than livestock to him. Okay, he made us himself, as we saw in John 1, in the image of God. You are very precious to him. You're not just a number to him. He calls you by name. Revelation 20 says that each of our names are written in the book of life. Luke 12 says he knows the number of hairs on your head. Psalm 56 says he keeps track of each of your tears and that they're very precious to him. He records them. Galatians 2, Paul says, the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. He calls you by name. He cares for you. Some of you guys know Charlie, our golden retriever. And I know he gets very happy when we have prayer meetings and small groups and visitors in our home. Most of the time, he is the most laid-back dog I've ever known. That guy could sleep for America. Our previous dog before Charlie was the opposite. He was a beautiful working cocker spaniel called Oscar, one of the most intense dogs I've ever met. And when we lived in London, one of the highlights of my day each evening was walking him in some nearby woods in a nearby nature reserve. And Oscar used to love to roam for miles. And when I hadn't seen him for a couple of minutes, I'd call his name at the top of my voice. And I'd listen. Wouldn't hear anything for a bit. And then in the far distance, maybe like a mile away, half a mile away, I'd hear something crashing through the undergrowth at high speed. And I would hear it get nearer and nearer and nearer and nearer. And then out of the bushes would shoot this dog-shaped missile, just a blur of red fur, and it would crash into my legs, wagging crazily, covered in mud, covering me in mud, trying to cover me in very slobbery kisses. And if Oscar could speak, and I had asked him, hey, Oscar, why did you come? He would have said he came because he heard my call and recognized my voice. He would have said that he was instinctively drawn to me by instinct, found himself just responding to the call of his true master. So for the believers among us, take comfort, take confidence. Jesus Christ knows you and loves you and calls you by name. And that instinct that you have deep down inside you, which is what you're even doing here tonight instead of living for yourself, that instinct that knows that his gospel has the ring of truth about it, that causes you to respond to it, that's you recognizing his voice. So like I say, take comfort, take confidence. If you recognize his voice, the voice of the gospel, that shows he securely has you. You're one of his. That's how you can recognize his voice. The fact that he has you and he loves you. And the fact that his call penetrates your soul and compels you to respond to it authenticates him. That's the end of our first point. It authenticates him as being the real deal, the true leader, in contrast to all the false shepherds, the good shepherd. Well, second, this passage then moves on to his blessings. And this is now in verses 7 to 18. Let me read verse 7 again. So Jesus again said to them, I am the door of the sheep. And we've talked about this in previous messages already. I won't belabor the point, but there are seven I am sayings scattered throughout. Scattered sounds random. Everything's deliberate in John. Incredibly sophisticated writer, placed throughout John's gospel. And each time Jesus says, I am, dot, 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 what he's doing is claiming divinity. He's saying, I'm Yahweh himself in flesh. That's what I am literally means in Hebrew. And I am the door to the sheep is number 3 out of 7. And his claim to divinity here is about how he's the only way to enter God's people. He's the only way into God's family. He's the door to the sheepfold. Remember the picture at the beginning, the wall all the way around, only one way in and out. Jesus is saying, I am that one way, as Yahweh. And as such, he's the source of amazing blessings to his people. Here are three of them. Eternal salvation, verse 9. He says, I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved. Here's another, security and nurture. Let me read on in verse 9. He will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. In other words, will be safe. He'll be able to go in and out in safety and be nourished and cared for and nurtured. Here's another blessing, abundance of life, verse 10. Jesus says, the thief comes only to steal and destroy, and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. Another translation puts it, life to the full. In the 90s, there was a box office hit classic movie called Free Willy, all about this orca whale. Wonder if anyone remembers that. And soon after it came out, that the media discovered that just like in the movie, this whale called Kiko really did live in this like horrible environment. Here's what one magazine wrote. Let me quote. His tank at Mexico City's theme park, full of chlorinated, artificially salted water, was barely large enough for the 21-foot animal to turn around in. His muscles had turned flabby, and constant swimming in one direction had curled his dorsal fin. His water was far too warm. An inadequate filtration system had him swimming in his own waste, and he was breathing the world's smoggiest air. These hardships, along with his improper diet, had weakened his immune system. He was over 1,000 pounds underweight. Imagine being over 1,000 pounds underweight. And his skin kept breaking out in warts. In his frustration, he had taken to gnawing at the edge of the pool, a habit that wore his teeth down to stubs. And so because of this awful tragedy, the scandal, a lot of people started campaigning for him. The movies sort of Free Willy became, you know, reality, real life. And after several years, they'd raised enough money to build him a new tank at a massive aquarium in Oregon. And this new tank was 4 times bigger than the one had been in Mexico. It was filled with much colder seawater, straight from the nearby bay. It featured reversible currents for him to have to fight against, water jets to play among, even submerged rocks for his navigation practice. And so at the start of 1996, Kiko was flown to his new home. Within a year, he'd gained 1,000 pounds. His skin cleared up, his dorsal fin started to straighten again. That is a tiny picture of what it means for people to go through the one and only door to salvation of Jesus Christ and start to experience his blessings. I'm not saying you're going to gain 1,000 pounds, don't panic, but you get the picture. You know, people on the other side of the door of Jesus may look like they're doing fine on some surface shallow level, like how much money they make or how successful they are. Maybe they are doing fine. The reality is that if they haven't gone through the door of Jesus Christ, they are like Kiko in his first home. They are spiritually, they're dying. And although living for Jesus does sometimes make life harder, you have to make sacrifices. You face persecution. It is infinitely healthier. It's what we were made for. It's much more joyful on a deep level. It'll give you hope, something to live for bigger than yourself, that's truly meaningful, the most and the only meaningful thing in the whole universe. And it means eternal salvation after this life and loving nurture in this life. And that's the sense in which it's life to the full. And then in verses 11 to 15, we see how these blessings have been won for us by Jesus. Verse 11, he says, I am, as the I am saying again, in other words, Yahweh, you're looking at him. I am, this time, the good shepherd. That's I am saying number four. Here's how the good shepherd obtains those blessings for his sheep, reading on in verse 11. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. When Jesus died on the cross, he was taking upon himself God's rightful, horrific, holy judgment, the punishment in place of our sins, so that instead of that judgment, we might have eternal friendship with God, and therefore all of those blessings I just talked about. And that's contrasted with the false leaders Jesus describes in verses 12 and 13, who aren't committed to the sheep, who don't care for the sheep, who at the first sign of trouble abandon the sheep. Turn the sheep over to the wolf, over to Satan himself. So they don't lay down their lives for the sheep. They do the exact opposite, which is kind of interesting. They lay their sheep's lives down for them. It's what prosperity gospel preachers and all manner of false teachers do. They lay other people's lives down for their benefit. That's a great way to spot any false religious leader. They don't serve their people. They make their people serve them. That's what a cult is. They're not passionately, sacrificially committed to their people. They're in it for themselves. Contrast Jesus at the end of verse 15. I lay down my life for the sheep. And we're going to witness him doing that in a few chapters' time. So we've seen what the blessings are, how they're won by the Good Shepherd laying down his life for us. Final thing under point two of the blessings is who the blessings are for. And we see this in verse 16. He says, and I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. Now guess who those other sheep are? Answer. I'm looking at them. Us. Rank outsiders. You know, people who Jesus' original listeners would never have imagined in a million years. You know, Gentiles, thousands of miles away in this continent they didn't even know about, America. Thousands of years later. And yet look at us. We're like almost aliens compared to his original listeners. If only they could see us tonight. And yet here we are. Each of us heard him call our name. Whether it was in that Sunday school when you were six or that sermon when you were 26 or whenever. And each of us responded, and here we are. Other sheep. Fancy that. What a privilege. We won the lottery. And if we extend this principle, what it also means is that we should never, ever discount anyone else from being potentially elect. No matter how far from God they might seem, how unlikely a candidate for following Jesus they might be to our surface judgment of them. Just like membership in God's flock wasn't just for people in Jesus' lifetime, just for Jewish people, just for religious people, So today, we've also got to keep remembering Jesus has other sheep. They need bringing in also. They need witnessing to by us, so they can hear the Master's voice. And some of them will recognize it, and therefore they'll respond to it. And I think we'll see more and more of them joining our number in Emmanuel in the coming years. So who does God mean you to keep building a friendship with, patiently, lovingly, intentionally, in your neighborhood, in your office, and praying for, and then bringing to church next week? As Jesus said, I have other sheep, not of this fold, I must bring them also. He's waiting for you to bring them under the sound of his voice, and they'll recognize it and respond. And many won't, but the promise here is that some will. And by the way, just before I wrap up briefly with the final point, this is also why our global mission partners at Emmanuel are focused on reaching truly unreached people groups. That's the Great Commission, to reach all nations, not just the ones that have already been reached, because Jesus has other sheep also. He's got to bring them in. So that brings us finally, briefly, to the Good Shepherd's sacrifice. We've had his authentications, his blessing, now his sacrifice. And this is just in verses 17 and 18. And to illustrate this point first, before I just unpick it briefly, I want to share a short modern-day parable written by one Christian writer designed to capture this point. And he wrote the following. Once upon a time, there was a land ruled by a wicked prince. He had come from a foreign country and enslaved all the people of the land and made them miserable with hard labor in his coal mines across the deep canyon. He had built a massive railway for the trains that carried his slaves across the canyon to the mines each morning, and it was heavily guarded. Two men were still free in this kingdom, however, one old and one young. They lived on an inaccessible cliff overlooking the railway. They hated it. At last, they resolved together to blow it up and destroy the slave labor of the enemy prince. They planned and they prayed and they reminded themselves of the reality of heaven. And then the night came when the deed would be done. Their hearts were pounding with joy. It was a hard plan. It would be possible to time the trek of the railway guard so the explosive could be carried quickly to the vulnerable spot on the railway, but there would be no time for the carrier of the explosives to return. It was agreed that he would be seen, and the plan foiled if he tried to return. To make sure the railway blew up, the two men agreed that the young man would detonate it by hand on the railway. He would blow up with it. But they believed in heaven, and they loved the people of the land. And so the honor of this sacrifice made their hearts leap with joy. The hour came. They folded up the map of their strategy, stood from the table, and embraced each other. When the young man got to the door, he turned with the explosive strapped to his back, looked at the old man and said, "I love you, Father." And the old man took a deep breath and said, "I love you too, son." That's what's going on in these verses. Exactly that. Here's the first thing we learn about Jesus' sacrifice for us. Just got three subpoints. Number one, the Father loves the Son because of his sacrifice. Verse 17, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life." Number two, the Son's death was voluntary. Verse 18, "No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord." And number three, Jesus' death is tied to his subsequent resurrection. End of verse 17. "I lay down my life that I may take it up again." Halfway through verse 18, "I have the authority to take it up again." So Jesus says basically everything I've just said. All I've done is just passed on, you know, the content of his teaching. So his listeners hear the sermon that you've just heard, and then there's a reaction. And I wonder if there's going to be the same reaction tonight in the blue room after this. I hope not, because the reaction in verse 19 is pretty polarized. Have a look at verse 19. There was again a division among the Jews because of these words. Many of them said, he has a demon. He's insane. Why listen to him? And there's that vicious opposition to Jesus we're getting more and more used to in John's gospel. But others said, these are not the words of one who's oppressed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? And that's what we saw Jesus do last week in John 9. And the reason John gives us this massive fork in the road, this division, he highlights it for us partly to put the ball in our court. This gospel is heavily evangelistic. John is asking us, by showing us these two reactions, he's saying, which are you? Which way are you going to take this fork in the road? Which way are you going to jump? What do you make of Jesus? Are we going to be confident about his authentication, that he's the real deal, enjoy his blessings, experience the eternal life that he brings us by his sacrifice, entrust our lives to him, let him be our good shepherd, or are we not? Which by default means rejecting him, however politely or respectably we might do that. And if someone here has been drifting maybe a little bit from the good shepherd, as sheep do, you know, tonight would be a perfect opportunity to rededicate your life to him. So before I pray now, let's just have some quiet to consider. Which aspect of Jesus' ministry that we've seen here, whether it's his authentication or his blessings or his sacrifice, do I most need to take away with me tonight as a comfort, maybe as a challenge, that I've been sort of assuming or grown complacent about or bored with? Maybe one of them has been put before me tonight by God to cheer me up, to give me strength for a particular situation. So which aspect of Jesus' ministry, whether his authentication or his blessings or his sacrifice, do I most need to take away with me tonight as a comfort or a challenge? Let's take some quiet to think about that before I close in prayer.